The alleged contacts of Adamski, Cedric Allingham, Truman Bethurum, Sirigusa, Daniel Fry and some others do not have as corroborative evidence as that of Castle, since everything in them depends on what the contact says. In the case of Canigou, the presence of a spacecraft, a disc or any other type of space vehicle is not recorded. The presence of the tent gives rise to many suppositions. Was it a disc-shaped, flattened, metallic gray means of transport, which Jaime took for the latest model tent? The observation made by the eminent and scholarly Frenchman Jacques Vallée, a doctor in mathematics, NASA advisor on the map of Mars, specialist in IBM calculating machines and one of the world's leading experts on unidentified flying objects, a subject on which he has published several works in English, is very significant. In his list of 200 UFO landing cases, numbered 55 and dated the 4th of October 1954, he says that a 10-year-old boy named Barshiauk saw a tent-shaped object that had landed near Villers-les-Tulle, Ardennes, France. An unknown individual was standing next to him. But in this case, that of Canigou, there is testimony from almost all the inhabitants of a town. In May 1967, in Castle, there were several people who had known Jaime when he was running the Hostel de l'Isard. Among them, Michel Cases, owner of the hotel-restaurant Le Catalan. The Canigou Mountains is perfectly known from a geological point of view, but the truth is that the planes that fly over it suffer strange magnetic disturbances in their navigation devices. Something or someone is disturbing the compasses and direction finders of aircraft in the vicinity of the mysterious and poetic mountains, which on a map of Europe occupies a space smaller than an old 5-cent coin. However, this small circle constitutes the largest aircraft graveyard in Europe. The conclusion of each of the surveys carried out was always the same: navigation error. But what is the natural, known and proven reason that makes so many experienced pilots, guided by a comprehensive network of radio beacons from the ground, always make the same mistake and in the same place? The technicians respond that it is an unfortunate coincidence. The most basic calculation of probabilities tells us that we can no longer speak of coincidences in the case of Canigou, a case that recalls the deadly Bermuda Triangle, a mysterious triangular area that exists in the sea, off the Florida Peninsula, where dozens of ships and planes have mysteriously disappeared in broad daylight and in dead calm. Could there be magnetic disturbance centers on our planet capable of driving air and sea navigation instruments crazy? If so, what is the cause? Could the top-secret Project Magnet of the American Air Force, consisting of several flying superfortresses equipped with perfect magnetometers, be related to this? And finally, what relationship, if any, does the unknown from Castle have with these tragic and mournful events? Be that as it may, it is worth noting that, for a truly incomprehensible reason, the stranger, the Castle episode was soon erased from James' mind, and he suffered a total temporary amnesia that lasted about 10 years. Was it a psychological block imposed from above? The enigma remains and we are possibly still very far from its solution. However, the unknown predicted to Jaime that his life would change and that he would be subject to very violent shocks. Subsequent events seem to confirm this prediction. Indeed, in the summer of 1971, Jaime was in his magnificent chalet in Andorra and in the company of Odile, his Parisian wife whom he met shortly after the events described above, when he received a mysterious call from Paris. The voice was the same one he had heard in Castle in 1951, that of the unknown character, who told him, "I am speaking to you from a car in the Bois de Vincennes. You will experience a new mutation. You will stop aging, and your mind will open to broader truths." In 1967, Raphael Farioles and I went to Castle to carry out a detailed investigation on site. We interviewed several people who still remembered Jaime Borders and the bizarre being who went to fetch bread and milk, that is, the strange being of our story. Among these witnesses were the aforementioned Michel Cases, M. New, former mayor of the village, Jean Pye, a fruit tree grower, and a few others. Borders had confided to me, as you will remember, the names of the jewelers who acquired the gold nuggets given to him by the unknown, the Ducamont brothers. By a fortunate coincidence, one of them, Henri, was then vice president of the French Federation of Underwater Studies and Sports. Being one of the pioneers of scuba diving in Spain, the author of several works on the subject, a personal friend of Commander Cousteau and other personalities in the underwater world, I was already guaranteed a good reception from the jeweler who, as I later found out, did indeed know my name. The Ducamont Ferrier's jewelry store is located in one of the most central locations in Perpignan, in the square that opens up at the foot of the Castellet. Henri Ducamont welcomed me kindly. I introduced him to Farioles and then explained the reason for our visit, after making a few comments about diving and telling me about a compressor for loading bottles that he had installed in Roses. Indeed, I remember Jacques Borders perfectly, he told me. He was a mountain guide who then ran the Mountain Hotel in Castle. He was a strong, friendly man and very pleasant to deal with. Do you remember if he ever brought you gold nuggets to sell? Yes, answered Henri Ducamont, I think it was around the year 50 or 51, I don't remember exactly. As you know, he added, the river basin is gold-bearing, but no one had ever brought back nuggets of that quality. Once this last point was confirmed, which seemed to corroborate the veracity of the strange story, Farioles and I resumed our return to Barcelona, in my friend's Morris 1100. While inside us this question arose, could the unknown from Canigó be one of the first men from Amo to arrive on Earth? The dates matched, March 1950, June 1951. A little more than a year later, the question remains. Other Spanish cases. These cases are offered to us by Juan José Benitez, the Spanish journalist writer most specialized in the UFO subject. All of them involved inhabitants of the Canary Islands. First case. On June 23, 1976, the Diario de Avisos of the island of Tenerife published this news, boxed and on the front page, last night, spectacular phenomenon in Canary waters. Thousands of people saw it. Four hypotheses, an underwater volcano, a meteorite that fell into the sea, another atmospheric marine phenomenon or something related to UFOs. Testimonies, that of Mr. Guillermo Rodriguez, who worked at the ISO Observatory, and who is now a professor at the Los Llanos Aridane Institute. From what I have seen, I deduce that there was a great atmospheric ionization, during most of the time that this phenomenon lasted, unknown for now. The television was seen with difficulty. The image was erased from the screen, as if there was interference from electromagnetic waves, or something had passed over the area. That of Mr. Fernando Molino, from the ISO Astronomical Observatory. I saw it as a large spiral in the shape of a snail, very bright. It produced a 40-degree circular halo, with a bluish-white luminosity. What is clear is that it was something of external origin to the islands. The previous night, June 22 to the 23rd, 1976, the following news was transmitted from San Sebastián de la Gomera. The crew of a fishing boat, impressed by the UFO that stopped next to the mast. The crew of the fishing boat Madura Baitati, which was fishing off the coast of Alajuela, are deeply impressed, since they claim that a craft, the large object, shaped like two fishing boats on top of each other, emitted very intense flashes of light. It stopped at the height of the boat's mast, where it remained for a few seconds until it disappeared, when, alarmed, they turned off the boat's lights. The phenomenon has been observed by many people who have been impressed by its magnitude. Now Ernst Ferragallen, the janitor of the aforementioned ISO Observatory, located 2,300 meters above sea level, speaks, at first, the sea turned red, but emerged between the island of La Palma and Teide. Suddenly, from that reddened sea something emerged that looked like a spiral, also red, and at the same time that the spiral was forming, a tremendous white luminosity was filling that place. I remember that we received more than 15 calls from many places and especially from the city of Puerto de la Cruz. Apparently, thousands of people saw it. Second case. On June 22, 1976, at 10 o'clock at night, Dr. Francisco Padron Hernandez experienced an exciting adventure. It, the sphere, had a light orange-bluish color at first. They were shades that I have never seen in nature. It was an orange with a special blue tint. None of the three occupants of the taxi spoke. But I realized that the taxi driver's hands were shaking. And the car, very slowly, left it there. Anyway, since no one was speaking, I commented. But what's going on here? The taxi driver answered me, "Can't you see it? This is a flying saucer. It even has two guys inside." I had indeed seen those two beings too. But I wanted to make sure that I wasn't suffering from a hallucination or something like that. I saw and perceived the two beings. And it was already beginning to blur. Yes, at first it was not transparent. Then, slowly, the large sphere became transparent. In the central part of the alien spaceship, as if in relief, there were two platforms, all round. There were no rivets or angles of any kind. The disc was like a compass-shaped pattern. Perfect. And, suddenly, we see how from the central part of this inner platform, through a strange tube, a gas or smoke began to emerge, of much denser or thicker blue. And it began to travel around the inner circumference of the sphere, and that began to increase in size and grow and grow. And it reached the diameter of a 20-story house. Like the Don Juan Hotel in Las Palmas. From the waist down, the two figures in the ship seemed short to me. But from there up, enormous. Their shoulders were considerably wide. And so was their skull. I was struck by their disproportionate occipitals. At least, they measured that. 2.70 meters their hands were pointed. They had no fingers. And, if they did have them, they were kept or sheathed in something pointed or conical. The witnesses were about 50 or 60 meters from the sphere. Yes, the uniforms were red. It wasn't exactly red either, wine red. I've never seen it in nature. Those suits were perfect. I was struck by the perfection of those uniforms. There were no wrinkles. Were they clearly human figures? The journalist asked him. The doctor did not hesitate for a moment. Yes. At that moment, the journalist continued, I asked the doctor to draw the scene for me. While he was drawing the sphere, the panels and two beings, he commented, I will do it just like the commander who interrogated me recently. The two beings, as I was saying, were between these two panels. And above them there was a series of levers and devices that shone extraordinarily. They flashed. But I noticed a very special kind of whistling, like when I have the X-ray machine on, at 90,000 volts. Something like that. But today, calm now, with that image stuck in my mind and crystal clear, look, I am sure that I will go back there and see them again. Many of those experiences, during 18 years of practicing medicine, must have left a great mark on me. Well, the mark that this object left in my brain was completely different. How would you define that mark? Asked the journalist. I would do it in a few words, answered the rural doctor from Gia. It is an image that has displaced loads of images, to become a primordial one. Did you feel afraid at that moment? The doctor's answer was blunt, not at all. Quite the opposite. I liked seeing that. I liked it. And I don't know exactly why. Maybe because of its great perfection in the layout. It was something far superior to anything I had seen before. I myself am now recalling images of airplanes, even the Concorde, and they are just rubbish compared to that. And that object, pay close attention to what I am going to tell you, was accompanied, I don't know if psychically, by a strange phenomenon of joy. It's curious. You observe things on Earth, you see. For example, a commercial jet in flight, and it doesn't matter. But it wasn't the same with that object. Well, and after all this time, in a cool head and after having made a detailed analysis of everything that happened in your mind, what do you suppose it was that you saw? First, A ship, I call it that, that was not material. Second, occupied by beings far superior to us, in every sense. Third, from what I could observe, they were beings who carry, in their way of being, a great spiritual perfection. It gave me the impression that there was no evil there. But on what do you base this last conclusion? Simply by looking at the earth, answered the doctor. We all remained silent for a few moments. If you observe man, here in our world, that man is not surrounded by anything. He does not produce any strange sensation, and much less of greatness or majesty. It's just matter that moves. You see a big car and some people who get into it and nothing else. You don't see anything else. Just matter. The car may be more or less pretty, yes, but it doesn't give off spirituality. And what I saw did give off that spirituality. I don't know if you understood me. There were flashes of spirituality. And it's not that that spirituality was dependent on its physical perfection, no. A series of perfect things were associated with that set. Had you read any book about UFOs before? No, never. I had heard about them, yes. But it never worried me. As you can understand, one has enough problems with medicine. Did you notice an abnormal silence in the area? Yes. And how would you describe it? It was, I don't know. Maybe like an empty silence. There are full silences. The silences of the night or of the wind, for example. And the movements prior to the displacement, what were they like? I tell you. Very soft. Harmonious. Imagine a sphere of that size. That had nothing to do with the movements of our planes. It seemed like a game. You can't even imagine it. Everything in our world, compared to that, seems arid. Did the brightness of the sphere bother the eyes? No, quite the opposite. It was pleasant to look at. Of the whole UFO, what impressed you the most? Everything. You couldn't separate it. Everything was majestic. It was a harmonious whole. And what else surprised you? Well, perhaps the roundness. Everything there was rounded. I didn't see any corners or angles anywhere. The journalist J.J. Benitez emphasizes, it was really curious. That reminded me, almost unintentionally, of the statements of the members of the Peruvian Institute of Interplanetary Relations, who in 1974 had already specified to me that inside the ships of the beings from space who visit us, they had not observed any angle or corner. After the sighting, have you noticed any reaction or secondary effect on yourself? Yes, I have noticed something very specific and surprising. As a result of that, I have found that my memory is much more consistent. I have a much more lucid memory, even if it seems untrue. In addition, when I study, I grasp things and concepts in less time than before and with more depth. And, finally, diagnoses or reasoning in general are almost effortless for me. And I assure you that it has not been a product of my imagination. I have been practicing medicine for 18 years and there have been many diagnoses that have required a great effort, numerous studies and time. Some, I even left for another day. Today, however, I reason them with great ease. I also notice a great deal of self-confidence. When asked to what extent the meeting had meant a change in my life, Dr. Francisco Padron replied, I'll tell you something. As I said, I've been a doctor for 18 years, here in Gia. At the beginning, I devoted myself entirely to my career. In agreement with my wife, I devoted hours and hours to my work and she looked after the children. I went 2 or even 3 days without sleeping. Until one day, this was about 5 or 6 years ago, I realized that this was not life. And I made a decision. What was the life of a doctor? What was my role in this world, working 24 or 48 hours straight? What was I and what did I represent? And I tried to put my life in order. I started by not prescribing once a week. In short, making sure that my profession did not enslave me. And I dedicated more time to my wife and children. Because I thought, if I am a doctor who dedicates my life, entirely, to the profession, before I know it I will have a cane, a hat and a frock coat and I will not be able to stand up. And I promised myself that this would not happen. How? By practicing my profession as dignifiedly as possible and devoting the rest of the time to my home. Well, those two things I told you I have seen much more clearly now. For the soldier who came to question me, for example, only the ship, his instruments and his words counted. Their propulsion system, etc. The military man is cold. And perhaps he cannot understand that that spirituality was inseparable from the rest of the ship. The military man does not understand this point. Suppose that based on that spirituality, those beings invited you to enter their ships. What would you do? Honestly, today, I think I am not ready for that. Did you not think then about the consequences that that declaration, the encounter with them and their sphere, would bring you? No. That does not concern me. I believed I had the obligation to say what I had seen. And that is all. What ignorant or ill-intentioned people think leaves me absolutely cold. I am above all those people who do not understand or who mock. As you will understand, I cannot value the comment of a corner or a square. Those are the ones who fix the world by talking. The person who is formed has to be above all that. You cannot hide something that was real or stop expressing your thoughts because of what will people say. Now, do you believe that UFOs exist? Of course. You would have to be blind not to believe. Although I will also tell you something, there are many people who pretend to be blind, so as not to have to revise their outdated and comfortable principles. And those are the worst. And the journalist concludes the interview, which lasted several hours, with these clarifications. The aforementioned doctor, as I was able to find out and confirm for myself in the hard-working town of Gia, as well as in the wide area surrounding said town, is one of the most beloved and respected professionals in those parts. He is a deeply serious and hard-working man, who had never worried about anything other than medicine, his home and his patients. It was obvious, on that unforgettable date when we went to his office to interview him, it was necessary to wait until late at night, to be able to talk with a minimum of tranquility. Patients were constantly filling the waiting room. His medical history, moreover, is brilliant. In this last case, as J.J. Bennett has already did when he included this testimony in his book, I have been forced to extract this statement. The length of these testimonies, that of Joe Aquin Borders and that of Dr. Francisco Padron, has allowed me, on the other hand, to shorten mine somewhat, due to the large number of coincidences between our respective experiences. Very notable in the case of Dr. Padron, who did not go up in any extraterrestrial spaceship, at least physically. I agree with him in almost 100% of his assessments. At the foot of the Sierra Tiguerina. One Sunday in January 1982, the presenter-commentator of Revista de Tres, the Valencian Manolo Moles, interviewed the couple Pedro and Pepa Vidal, field workers on a farm livestock farm located at the foot of the Sierra Tiguerina, NW of Seville. In this property, at the beginning of December 1981, a flying saucer landed. It was 11 o'clock at night and the first to see it was the Vidal couple's son, Diego, aged 15, who called his mother who came out of the house to see that strange device, which emitted an intense light. Mrs. Paper described it as a very pretty light. The son, overcome with fear, went into the house and did not come out again until the following day. What's more, when he went to the village he did not dare to speak about it to anyone, for fear of being taken for a madman. And when Manolo Moles went to interview the family, he refused to appear on television. What a youthful adventurous mentality these days. When he came back into the house, after having spent a few minutes outside, looking at the UFO, the mother told Diego not to wake his father. No doubt for fear that he would take up the shotgun and confront the intruders. The woman went out a couple of times to see the UFO, until she saw it take flight around midnight, with many red lights that turned on and off. According to the Vidal couple, the apparition had been observed that same night by several farmers in the area. Both there, at the foot of the Guirina mountain range, and in other Andalusian farms, where Manila Moles decided to spend Christmas among those who raise fighting bulls, when he asked country people of different ages what they appreciated most about their lives, they all answered unanimously, tranquility. Some of those people had lived in Madrid and Barcelona. I remember that a few years ago, the second channel of French television offered, once a week, a program entitled Les Cantas, in which peasants from all regions of France appeared on the small screen, delicately led and guided by the visitor commentator, whose name I regret not to remember, because he was a true goldsmith in the field, to tell their lives, their experiences and sometimes the legends and customs of the place. It is curious, I remember perfectly that, when I was a visitor, I was very interested in the story of the peasants from all regions of France. When I asked them what they appreciated most about their life in the countryside, they all responded with the same answer, the peace and the silence. I emphasize this because the reader will have been able to see, in my writings about a long conversation and its long silences, the affinity that exists between the thinking of the peasants on Earth and the crew of the spaceship with whom I spoke. And also that on our planet there are people who could teach many other people how to live, those who go from trauma to depression, with stress as the launching pad for all the abnormal alterations of their existence, who have not been able to preserve even the slightest notion of what a normal and peaceful life is. These days, the press reproduced reflections by Spanish executives from various branches, banking, arms, public administration, politics, victims of stress. They pointed out that the solution might be to apply the sabbatical year. That is to say, every 7 years take 1 year off, receiving, naturally, your usual emoluments. But if such a revolutionary innovation were to be applied, it would only be suitable, according to indications, for stressed executives. The working class, apparently, does not know stress, nor does it deserve to benefit from sabbatical holidays. A brief profile. And some clarifications. The people we starve and torture have an antisocial tendency to steal and kill. And we believe that they act in this way because of a prominent eyebrow. Andrew Yin, sociologist and researcher. But the truth is that there is no way to distinguish between the brains of murderers and those of scientists. It is undoubtedly the case that it is not heredity but society that makes criminals. Carl Sagan, astronomer, researcher and writer. A brief profile. In broad strokes, this is the adventurous and exciting life, in many ways, of a good friend of mine, an old militant of the National Confederation of Labour and, at the turn of the 20s and 30s, an active member of the Iberian Anarchist Federation. It is also, at the same time, my most sincere tribute to all those men and women who, against all odds, gave everything to make universal brotherhood the purest ambition of the human race. Manuel Huet Piro is a son of the Barcelona neighborhood of Pueblo Nuevo, and although from a very young age he had his life sorted out, he drove his own taxi from the age of 23, he was always at the service of the ideas he professed. And so he risked his peace of mind, his well-being and his life, and that of his loved ones, countless times, first in Spain and later in France, until the age of 60. His life as a fighter for freedom and human dignity is one of the most intense I have ever known. And I know many. Until one day he said enough. And he left it all behind. But, as the younger generations of libertarians entered the fray, particularly between 1944 and 1960, there were those who approached the old militant. Some in search of advice, others asking for guidance and some trying to get him involved in the fight again. Then he, bluntly, to free himself definitively from the siege of one and the other, replied, "What do you want, that I go back into the mountains to save humanity? Well, if that is what it is for, don't count on me for anything. I am tired of acting as a savior. Humanity did not deserve so many sacrifices and so much bloodshed." And, after a brief pause, because his bellows were no longer working very well, he added, "When you want to exterminate humanity, then you can come for me, and I will give you a good hand." It is not difficult to imagine the expressions on the faces of his interlocutors, the young fighters in the background. Some of them, even with a touch of indignation, would repeat to me at home those unexpected words of the old anarcho syndicalist militant, recently returned from the Andorran retirement of the former Barcelona taxi driver. And some clarifications.